Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The New Statesman.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm senior editor Alona Ferber. On today's episode of the podcast, we'll be looking back at the 2010s, the figures, events, and politics that defined this decade, and asking, why did the left's aspirations for revolution during the 2010s fall short? It was a decade that many hoped would usher in a new era of leftist revolutions. Yet as we look back, the question looms large. What went wrong? I was joined by Will Davies, writer and professor in political economy at Goldsmiths, University of London, who wrote an essay for The New Statesman published in January titled The 2010s, A Decade of Revolutionaries Without a Revolution. Will's essay opens with a description of Russell Brand's evolution from lewd celebrity figure to left-wing activist and eventually now online conspiracy theorist. But how did Brand's shifting roles reflect broader changes in the political and cultural landscape of this period?
I guess the first thing to say about Brand is that anything we say about him in retrospect has now been overshadowed by the allegations of the last 6 months or so. And that, has to be recognized. And I think that we have to be cautious in how we handle his legacy in light of that. I think that the interesting thing about Brand to me when thinking particularly about this conjuncture of the post-financial crisis period, what broadly you could look at as a period that lasted between the collapse of Lehman Brothers in the autumn of 2008 and the initial lockdowns related to COVID-19 in early 2020. We know he became famous through things like Big Brother. He was a TV celebrity. I mean, in some ways, you know, a lot of the figures who ended up dominating the 2010s in politics had careers in areas such as the media. You think of someone like Boris Johnson. I mean, you know, has a similar sort of charisma, kind of status within the media as someone who simply just sort of had to be himself and be witty and somehow sort of drew attention towards himself. And that was obviously the Brand pre-2008 Brand. I think that the interesting thing about that decade, and this is why I used Brand to try and encapsulate something, was that one of the reasons he first gained attention as a political figure was with the with his interview with Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight, in which he said, really, there's no point in voting.
But is it true you don't even vote?
Yeah, no, I don't vote.
Well, how do you have any authority to talk about politics then?
Well, I don't get my authority from this pre-existing paradigm, which is quite narrow and only serves a few people. I look elsewhere for alternatives that might be of service to humanity. Alternate means, alternate political systems.
They being?
Well, I've not invented it yet, Jeremy.
Statistically, this wasn't actually a particularly unusual thing to do. I mean, turnouts in general elections had been falling since 1997. The 2001 election was a historically low turnout. So you could say that, you know, roughly a third of the electorate had already made up their minds that it wasn't worth voting by the time that Brand gave that interview with Paxman. But I think that the reason it drew so much attention was that he was expressing something about the failings of representative democracy, the limits of the electoral system that suddenly seemed kind of charismatic, mobilizing, energizing in certain ways. And then he said, you know, in the wake of that interview, he said, really, you know, the only thing that will work right now is a revolution. And again, you know, looking back on it, in some ways, it looks rather kind of embarrassing that this would have been seen as such a kind of an exciting and incendiary thing to say. And I mean, the New Statesman has its own kind of role in this.
In 2013, the New Statesman invited Russell Brand to guest edit an issue of the magazine. This was called The Revolution Issue.
And then he wrote a book called Revolution, which was a big bestseller. And so I suppose what the language of revolution hadn't been used very much over the kind of pre-financial crisis era. But in particular, this sort of recognition that there was a gap between what the people in the kind of populist jargon might want or need and what was expressed by the voting system was suddenly gaining this kind of extremely charismatic expression. And of course, we then saw all sorts of manifestations of that over subsequent years via Brexit and, you know, Corbynism and that sort of thing. But I think that, you know, he saw which way the wind was blowing, let's say.
But this was also a class issue. In his essay, Exiting the Vampire Castle, writer and cultural theorist Mark Fisher wrote, "For some of us, Brand's forensic takedown of Paxman was intensely moving, miraculous. I couldn't remember the last time a person from a working class background had been given the space to so consummately destroy a class superior using intelligence and reason."
Yeah, I mean, the Mark Fisher essay, which became notorious and I think something that I think in many ways, whether he regretted it, it certainly led to a lot of difficult relationships in various areas. And it's also then got picked up by people, I think, that Mark Fisher would have been appalled by as sort of, you know, a critique of cancel culture and wokeism and this sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, in the essay, Exiting the Vampire's Castle, he celebrated Russell Brand as being this example of someone who was proudly working class, proclaiming various truths that some elite cartel of both, which engulfs both the media and Westminster, had previously shut out in various ways. And that was something which Mark Fisher was arguing, as you say, on a class basis, that this was giving voice to something that previously had been there, but it had been silent. And it's true that if you're thinking about disengagement from democracy, the people who were withdrawing from the voting system, from elections over previous years and decades, tended to be the young and the working class.
But Mark Fisher wasn't the only figure on the left to embrace Brand and Brand's style of politics in the 2010s. He was a prominent voice at protests.
How much did you pay for your place?
It's rented.
What kind of rent are you paying?
Oh, I'm not interested in talking to you about my rent, mate. I'm here to support a very, very important campaign. And you, as a member of the media, have an important duty.
This is an issue that affects the 100%, because none of us can be happy as long as any of us are treated with discrimination, as long as any of us suffer from inequality.
And during the 2015 election, Labour leader Ed Miliband took part in a major interview with Brand on his YouTube channel, The Trues.
Look, I decided that some people were saying the campaign was too boring, so I thought I'd make it more interesting. But the serious point to this is as follows. There are millions of people in our country who are not watching this election, who are not listening to this election, and who think voting doesn't make a difference. And Russell Brand is one of the people who said in the past that voting doesn't make a difference. Now, I profoundly disagree with that. And I'm going to go anywhere and talk to anyone to take that message out to people about how we can change this country so it works for working people again.
What motivated the left to have this association with Brand?
I mean, we know that if we go back to that kind of, the first half of the 2010s, so you've got, you know, the coalition winning power in May 2010, introducing an austerity program. You've got the protests against tuition fees happening at the end of that year, and then those fees kicked in a couple of years later. You had this kind of a drastic kind of delimiting of what was considered possible. I mean, the other important expression which happened around about then was, I mean, Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism, which I think was published in 2009. It became a book that many people, it was short, it was very readable, it was very kind of, you know, it brought into questions the affective state of neoliberalism in relation to his own depression and some of the cultural manifestations of sort of a depressive culture, which says that the future has to be exactly the same or worse than the present. And that was what, you know, so much of Mark's writing over that period was about. I think that, you know, there was clearly what partly was being mobilized there was a generational phenomenon. And I think that's partly what Mark Fisher helped to give some voice to. But I think it also, in different ways, it was partly the brand, you call it a coalition, but certainly the kind of moment of excitement that here was all sorts of people that felt that they didn't really have any kind of voice at all. And that, of course, that, you know, the mechanism of the mainstream media and mainstream politics were not serving them in various ways. Now, one of the crucial ingredients in that was that in the past, if there were Paris people who felt that they had no means of expressing their alienation from the mainstream media or mainstream politics, other than becoming pamphleteers, which, of course, you know, some people did via kind of anarchist book fairs and that kind of thing, or writing letters to the newspaper, you didn't really have any other media with which to express that alienation. Social media, which came of age during this period. I think I got a Facebook account in 2007 and a smartphone in 2010. So it was round about the time of
an early adopter.
Well, I don't
relatively.
Know. Relatively, I suppose. But I think 2010 was the big turning point with phones, with smartphones. And I think the big platforms were, social media platforms were round about that. I think Twitter was a few years later. But I mean, you know, what they did and do so kind of with such unique capacity is to give voice to the discrepancy between the account of the world as given by the mainstream, in inverted commas, and how the mainstream feels to millions of people. And that's something which, you know, various anthropologists and theorists and ethnographers and sociologists have been interested in that for a long time. But the idea that people themselves are able to basically mobilize and say that system over there, I mean, I guess anti-war protests, which I kind of come onto at the end of the essay as well, is it would be, you know, where, you know, if you think of the Iraq protests of 2003, one of the most kind of frequently seen banners and signs in those protests is "Not in my name." And again, there's that idea of that what is done via the media and the institutions of representation of the mainstream, they do not reflect me in any way. I am outside of that system of representation. And that's what I think social media does so powerfully. It's what Brand was picking up on. I think Ed Miliband sort of dabbled with it in 2015 because I think he thought it might win him some crucial votes for that election, which we know he ultimately, although relatively narrowly, lost.
Will alluded there to those early heady days of social media when possibility and opportunity were rife. But the scale of danger and misuse that we know today had not yet reared its head. The fact that the financial crash and the rise of social media and big tech occupy the same moment in history is not a coincidence. But what is the connection?
When we look back historically on that period, the global financial crisis ran between sort of began in the summer of 2007. The banks were being still sort of stabilized and bailed out over 2009. And then you get the austerity period coming to 2010. I mean, we've already mentioned roughly what the sort of historical contours of the kind of big tech moment were, but they were sort of around about that period. I mean, one of the ways in which governments around the world, but I guess most importantly in this case, the United States government, responded to the global financial crisis was to basically try and sort of drown the financial system in extremely cheap credit through slashing interest rates to historically unprecedented low levels, but then also quantitative easing that was introduced to try and push interest rates down even further.
The concept of quantitative easing emerged in the early 2000s when the Bank of Japan faced deflation and a stagnant economy. The primary goal of QE is to increase the supply of money in the economy and encourage lending and spending. By purchasing assets, the central bank, which in this case was the Bank of England in 2009, injects money into the financial system.
What they can't do is ensure that the banks are actually lending to kind of productive entities such as, you know, manufacturing firms or new infrastructure projects or, you know, wind farms or sort of things which might actually have been kind of welcome uses for all of that very cheap credit over the 2010s. So a lot of it ended up going into real estate and the price of housing and so on went up and that kind of thing. But this extremely cheap credit was crucial in the development of platform business models such as, you know, Uber and this sort of thing, who actually offered no profits whatsoever. I mean, you know, indefinitely, basically. So one of the way in which they could approach their finances was to effectively say, you know, we have this plan where we're just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and everyone else is going to invest into us over time because it's so obvious that the future sort of belongs to us, that the price of the shares that you're going to buy, the amount of money that we're going to make financially, not necessarily through the profit of the business itself, will be enough to pay you back. So This very, very cheap credit was enabled tech companies to grow without having to actually offer any profits in return. And I mean, Amazon, I can't remember exactly when Amazon first returned a profit, but it was able to attract vast quantities of equity investment from the, I guess, mid-1990s onwards. And the profits came much, much later than that. Now, that obviously wasn't during the period of this ultra-cheap credit and quantitative easing, but I mean, one of the interesting features of platform business models is that in order to function, they have to get to a very, very large scale very quickly. You know, Uber wouldn't work if only a few people had it and only a few, there were only a few drivers, or it was only in one place but not in another place. Part of the way it works is to get very, very big as quickly as it possibly can. And to do that, it needs very large amounts of capital. And it was a period, that period after the global financial crisis, when there was when capital was struggling to find good returns because interest rates were so low that you couldn't, you know, simply putting your money into a bank was not going to earn you returns. So all of these other forms of what are potentially riskier investment became more rational to engage in.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The convergence of these particular events led to the emergence of figures like Brand calling for a revolution. But it also led to the rise of the political term populist. How did populism become the word du jour, and was it overused in describing everyone from Trump to Johnson to Duterte?
I mean, within the scholarly literature, populism is a style of rhetoric, actually. It's a way of addressing, trying to construct a people in the kind of political theory of this by drawing a moralistic distinction between the people who are considered to be kind of ordinary and decent and the elite who are considered to be self-interested, corrupt and sort of alien or foreign in some way. And this has all sorts of manifestations in history, and it has some, I think, you know, quite a lot of quite obvious anti-Semitic potential where it's been used in various ways to refer to, you know, certain minorities who are, you know, acting in a conspiratorial manner and exploiting this ordinary nation. And I think that styles of populist rhetoric, I mean, if you see it purely as a mode of rhetoric, you can spot it in nearly any political speech, in fact. I mean, you know, Thatcher was described as an authoritarian populist by Stuart Hall in the early 1980s. Blair, you know, when he described the forces of conservatism in his famous conference speech, that was, you know, viewed as being kind of brilliant example of populist rhetoric because it basically lumped together, you know, the cleverly lumped together. I mean, he was kind of referring to simultaneously the kind of trade unions and kind of, I guess, you know, various other aspects of the establishment. But cleverly and not coincidentally, was also referring to the name of the opposition party. So he was sort of lumping together various people who were sort of bad versus him and everyone who was on the side of modernity as good. So it was rhetoric. It works quite, you can see it in all sorts of ways.
And this was something Hillary Clinton did less well with her basket of deplorable speech at a campaign fundraising event in 2016.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. But that other basket of people are people who feel the government has let them down, the economy has let them down, nobody cares about them.
That was a speech she probably never expected to see light of day, I guess, which,
yes.
But yeah, and I don't think she ever thought they were the elite anyway. But I mean, obviously Clinton herself was a kind of victim of populist kind of line drawing where, you know, her speeches for Goldman Sachs and her, you know, association with Wall Street and Washington and Bill Clinton and so on was just sort of, you know, damned her in many people's eyes. I think what happened in the 2010s was that there were various startup parties like Podemos and Syriza and these sorts of parties that came along. And of course, you know, various manifestations of Farage startup activities. And, you know, in a way, the appetite for populism, I suppose, in that instance, arose because many people, as Brand had expressed, had come to see the mainstream political parties themselves as the elite. You know, so that, you know, the media are all part of it. The mainstream political parties are all part of it. Curiously, often big business and finance was not part of it, which is partly why I think often, you know, left populism has struggled so much over this period. Is that, I mean, I mentioned that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's 2019 manifesto launch was the speech was all about sort of, you know, that he was gunning for these billionaires.
The fundamentals of why we put my name forward to be leader of the party was nothing to do with me, it was to do with the principles behind what we're about, which is that austerity has been meted out on the poorest and most vulnerable people in our society. They are the ones who paid the price of the banking crisis of 2008. All the time, the very richest in our society have had tax breaks, giveaways and tax havens. I tell you what, they're on borrowed time because the Labour government is coming to change things around.
Again, an attempt at classic kind of populist rhetoric, which is like, we're all ordinary. The other thing which is, I think, worth saying about populist rhetoric, which in some ways makes it tricky terrain for the traditional left, is that the people within this political register are not defined by class. So it's not about the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie, as in a Marxist sense. The people would include the traditional proletariat working class, but they would also include aspects of the petty bourgeoisie and, you know, various other, and, you know, right-wing populism, of course, would also throw in, I don't know, all sorts of other, you know,
Donald Trump.
Yeah, you could have very rich people who are sort of, but they still eat burgers and sort of, you know, kind of you'd have a beer with them sort of thing. So it's never mapped cleanly onto class divisions, which has always made some parts of the left rather uncomfortable with it.
What hold did Jeremy Corbyn's brand of populism have in the UK in the 2010s?
Well, I mean, so first of all, there was the 2017 election, which was this kind of moment of, which was one of the many events in that kind of second half of the decade, which people were just sort of like, what the hell just happened? I think people were staggered by it, including people who were some of his most devout supporters. So that demonstrated that there was, you know, in some ways, a style of politics where one isn't constantly looking over one's shoulder worrying about how it's going to be represented, which I'm afraid is kind of what Keir Starmer is currently doing. I mean, you could say it's working very well with his 20-point lead in the polls, but he's, you know, everything he's doing is with one eye on the press and on how the Conservatives are going to represent it. And in a way, I think Corbyn won some credit in that election for not being like that. And I think there's a certain respect, even people who disagree with someone think, well, actually, at least you know who you are and what you believe. And I think that was something that many populist figures of that period won votes for. And again, I mean, I think Boris Johnson doesn't believe in anything, and I don't think he would. The whole image of him as the shopping trolley and Cummings's testimonies says it all. But I think, nevertheless, I think people still felt they kind of knew that he was, you know, he wasn't just a politician kind of thing. I think Corbyn's, I mean, you know, many people would say if you look at what was in the manifestos in 2017 and 2019. How radical was it really? I mean, it wasn't as fiscally radical as many people would have liked on the left. I mean, I think in some ways, I think what many people were hungry for was someone who was going to stand up and morally denounce things and to say that, I mean, after all, the interesting thing about, you know, what happened in the summer of 2015 was that Corbyn won that leadership election after Labour had adopted a policy of abstaining on the two-child cap on the welfare reform. So as soon as the Conservatives won the election that summer, the first thing they did was to go even harder on cracking down on the welfare payments to introduce the two-child limit on child benefit, which to this day is a kind of monstrosity.
Last week, the Resolution Foundation think tank released an analysis of the impact of the two-child limit and the benefit cap. They projected that by 2027-28, over half of children in larger families, that's families with three or more children, will be growing up in poverty.
that that summer, they Osborne instantly came in with that policy, and Corbyn was the only person to call it out. And I think there was a sense in which, you know, enough is enough. How long can we go on? We've now had sort of, you know, 5 or, you know, you could arguably sort of say 7 years if you included the sort of fallout from the financial crisis of these indefensible economic policies. And I think that partly the hunger for someone who will just simply sort of name certain things and recite certain truths. And of course, you know, obviously Corbyn himself came to prominence on the back of his foreign policy positions, not on the back of his domestic policy positions. So of course, you know, someone who had developed a reputation for standing on platforms denouncing things, mainly in relation to defense policies and military interventions, you know, had the sort of rhetorical kind of wherewithal to go around saying, well, this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong.
Corbyn's status in the 2010s transcended being a political figure. He wasn't just the leader of the Labour Party, but of a broader movement. And it's not difficult to draw comparisons between his rise to leadership with that of Russell Brand a few years earlier. In his essay, Will references the American journalist Vincent Bevan's book, If We Burn, a reported history of the mass protest decade. The vogue of horizontalism or leaderless democracy, which Bevan traces back to the American New Left and to anarchism, drew vast crowds into the streets and squares as an end in itself, quite aside from whatever demand such movements might or might not be able to express. So was Corbyn a political leader or celebrity? How did the absence of more traditional leadership for these movements impact their effectiveness? And what did they achieve?
Many of the biggest mobilizations, as we're seeing right now in relation to Gaza, are mobilizations against violence, against war. And I mean, it's relatively clear what the demand is in these instances for the violence to stop. And, you know, other things after that. But initially, what gets people onto the streets is the demand that things must cease immediately. Or in the case of Iraq, I guess, to not proceed. But I think, you know, Corbynism in the background, there was people who had been thinking, going back really to Tony Benn and some of the people around Benn, like John Landsman and others, and you know, some of the kind of new left figures that had mobilised around, you know, in places like the Greater London Council. John McDonnell had been in the Greater London Council in the early 1980s. But, you know, there was a lot of interest in forms of direct democracy and momentum, which was obviously the body that was created alongside Corbyn's successful leadership bid in 2015, was the fruit of several decades, really, of reflection about how could the left move beyond both a kind of parliamentarianism, but also kind of, you know, being mediated by the trade unions, to think about, you know, what would be the basis of this, of a sort of almost a sort of permanent campaign, I suppose. But there was quite a lot of thinking going on in the early 2010s by people like Maurice Glassman and Mark Steers and Jonathan Rutherford and people like that, who were interested in trying to think about kind of, you know, how do local communities start to kind of express their needs and wishes. And momentum was much more sort of digitally, digitally savvy, but also digitally inspired, of trying to think about these kind of swarm-like activities where people would have relative, you know, you try and lower the barriers to entry as much as possible so that as many people will kind of come and get involved. The quantity of participants is a sign of some kind of power, which, of course, is questionable. I mean, you know, it's not clear that does translate into political power. That's the difficulty. And I think that, you know, in some terms of what Starmer has tried to do with the Labour Party since taking over in 2020 is partly a sort of direct reversal of that type of thinking, and to recognise actually that politics is not simply about getting as many sort of allies as you possibly can. And actually politics is, you know, it's a rather more sort of cynical, or, you know, as I say towards the end of the essay, more in touch with the kind of realist political tradition of thinking about the who are the allies who have got power, where do you want to invest your political capital, a less exciting vision of politics, and in some ways the vision of politics that many people wanted to put behind them in those kind of, you know, Brand years of 2013, 14, 15.
I want to ask Will about another horizontal activist movement of the 2010s, which is the Me Too movement. This was a cultural moment and a social movement which ended up being largely defined by street protests and marches. Was this another example of a leaderless movement that didn't really achieve anything, or was it different?
No, I mean, that's interesting. And I think the other thing is, I mean, you could also, I mean, there's obviously been a lot of, I was just thinking also about thinking about racial politics as well in recent years. I mean, obviously 2020 was the year of the largest street protest the United States has ever seen in relation to in the context of Black Lives Matter. I think what, so the other interesting thing about social media to me is that, so not only does it provide manifestations of kind of affective dispositions that, you know, are not going to get written about in the Times or get talked about in Parliament, and yet they now have a media. It also allows for a sort of granularity of politics in terms of sort of being able to identify the politics of things that often get kind of overlooked because they are often quite seen to be you know, somehow sort of too small scale in terms of the sort of, I mean, there's a lot of sort of, you know, the right gets very mobilized by the concept of microaggressions and said, you know, it's all just nonsense and so on. But ultimately, the concept of microaggression does mean something. It does refer to something real, which you know, in my own lifetime, I can, you know, think of things that I might have sort of, you know, ways I might have behaved sort of, you know, in a meeting kind of 15 years ago that I wouldn't behave, you know, in terms of being conscious of who is speaking and who is not speaking and these sorts of things. These sorts of things, I'm sure that I was oblivious to things that other people in rooms were aware of 10, 15 years ago, which I'm now more conscious of. And that's obviously partly to do with my, you know, I work in university and it's to do with my sort of, you know, sort of demographic profile and that kind of thing. But I think Me Too as well, I don't think Me Too achieved nothing because I think Me Too created a public representation of something that previously had not had a public representation. It wasn't simply, and it wasn't trying to represent something that needed to be dealt with by Westminster. I mean, I'm sure there were things that could be dealt with by Westminster, but ultimately it was a demand at the level of sort of granular expressions for a change in relatively granular behaviour in terms of sort of, you know, in workplaces, obviously on public transport, you know, in terms of, you know, this sort of thing. So I think that's somewhat different because it didn't try to channel it via, it wasn't something which was aimed to be channeled via the institutions of representative democracy or the representative media necessarily. So I think it's an interesting one. And I think it was what social media was kind of uniquely capable of enabling, really. It was something that everybody knew, but nobody had been speaking about. Well, not every, let's say half the population knew.
Culturally and politically, we're in very different times right now. And when it comes to Labour, there is large momentum for an imminent Labour government. After reflecting on the history of the past 10 years, what does Will envision for the future of those sorts of mass leftist movements here in the UK?
Yeah, it's hard to say, really. I mean, I think what's going on in relation to Gaza, I think, plays quite a big part, and as it will play probably a bigger part in the United States in relation to the election coming later this year as well. Because I think, you know, one of the things that this remains to be seen, but I mean, it's not clear if how many people will be kind of permanently alienated from voting for parties that have refused to condemn Israel over the last 4 months. So that's one of the unknowns. I think that one of the things that as I discussed in the essay, I mean, you know, so Brand turned into this kind of online conspiracy theorist, and he's used that to try and defend himself against the allegations that were made in the autumn. He gave this interview with Tucker Carlson the other day, which was about, you know, Carlson saying Brand is being taken down by the government, and Brand's claiming he's being taken down by big media and big pharma and all this sort of stuff.
Significant attempts to control the information space that are so rigorously adhered to and protected that even what you might imagine to be a marginal voice is considered a significant enough threat to warrant coordinated media attacks, expenditure on peculiar clandestine non-government organisations and think tanks that take their money from the military-industrial complex, from the legacy media, who, by the way, when they're critiquing independent media, they got skin in the game. They're not able to independently assess your work or my work or the medical opinions of Joe Rogan. They have a vested interest in destroying those organisations.
I mean, one of the things I think many of us are sort of trying to grapple with is where does sort of a, you know, it's impossible to draw the line between a kind of healthy skepticism towards the mainstream and towards elites. And there are. I mean, whether the term elites is a helpful one or not, but I mean, it's clear that there are certain. Look at the donor class for the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party, despite being 20% behind in the polls, still out. You know, is raising more money than the Labour Party, who are, I don't know what the odds are at the moment, but overwhelmingly likely to perform the next government of the country. And yet, still these donors are kind of pouring money into the Conservative Party coffers. So, some sort of cynicism regarding how this sort of thing works is, I think, necessary. But where does that, you know, who gets called a conspiracy theorist in all of this? So one of the things I think it's not clear, and I think this is in some ways a question for sort of, I guess, digital sociologists, is where has the energy of kind of 2017 era momentum actually gone? I mean, what kinds of online communities has it gone into? What kinds of belief systems and ideologies has it gone into? I mean, there are certain manifestations of that period, like, you know, Navarra Media seems to be going from strength to strength, and I don't think has become any less kind of mainstream in its concerns. It hasn't sort of, you know, disappeared off into a kind of, you know, Russell Brand type sort of claims about the world, and seems to have, you know, a rising number of YouTube followers and that sort of thing. So that may be evidence that actually certain aspects of that sort of, you know, post 2010 millennial left remains sort of at least concerned about what happens in Westminster in various ways and hasn't just sort of written it off as a conspiracy in the way that Brand has. I don't know. Again, this is kind of an empirical question. You know, who are most of Brand's listeners? One of the things we learned during the COVID pandemic was that there's a huge amount of sort of anti-vax sentiment amongst, you know, a lot of the people who were spreading a lot of anti-vax conspiracy theorists were sort of wellness influencers and sort of yoga instructors. And you know, this generationally and demographically, this is probably not the same people who are, you know, necessarily were sort of supporting Jeremy Corbyn. Who knows? I'm sure there were overlaps.
There must be an overlap.
But I'm sure there are overlaps. But I think that I mean, after all, there are a lot of people who despise Jeremy Corbyn precisely because he, you know, lived in Islington and this sort of thing. But I'm sure, yeah, in terms of the sort of vegetarianism and that sort of thing, and also the anti-war mentality, because of course, being anti-war has become a much more complicated. I mean, Donald Trump is anti-war. I mean, there's sort of being anti-war has become much more complicated since, you know, in the last decade than it was. Positions on military interventions have become much more sort of confused, I think, in the last decade as well. But so, I mean, ultimately, I don't really know the answer to your question, but I think, you know, clearly Starmer is not worried about losing the support of those sort of swarms, because I think he still looks to 2016 as the Brexit vote as the sort of the moment when the sort of temperature of the country was most kind of acutely taken. Of course, Brexit was a referendum, not a first past the post electoral system. But, you know, it led to this kind of obsession with those red wall seats that I think still continues to shape a lot of what Starmer says about, you know, most things, actually.
Thanks for listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Ilona Ferber, and my guest, Will Davies. You can read Will's essay via the link in the show notes. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.